Similarly, Google, which performed the least well of the FANG stocks with 23% returns, also had the lowest volatility at 1.5%. As we learned in the preceding chapter, it's easy enough to directly calculate the risk-reward ratio of different assets. It would appear that in this time period, Facebook's IPO to January 3, 2017, Bitcoin has had the best risk-reward ratio of all these assets. But to make sure, we'll crunch the numbers. Sharpe ratio. Absolute returns and volatility are important in their own right, but when they're put together, they yield the Sharpe ratio, which is an equally important metric for investors to consider. Remember that by dividing the absolute returns by the volatility, we can calibrate the returns for the risk taken. The higher the Sharpe ratio, the more the asset is compensating investors for the risk. This is an extremely important metric in the context of modern portfolio theory, because while an aggressive investor may salivate over sexy returns, the innovative investor is equally aware of the risk necessary to achieve those returns. As discussed in the previous chapter, by combining returns and volatility into one metric, we can do an apples-to-apples comparison between crypto assets and other traditional and alternative assets. Currently, crypto assets often have much higher volatility than other assets, and the Sharpe ratio enables us to understand this volatility in terms of the returns reaped. It's still important to consider volatility outside of the Sharpe ratio in the context of the investor's time horizon. While some volatile assets will have excellent Sharpe ratios over long time periods, those investments may not be appropriate for someone needing to place a down payment on a house 3 months from now. In comparing Bitcoin to the FANG stocks, we observe that Bitcoin had the highest volatility, but also the highest returns by far. Interestingly, its Sharpe ratio was not just the highest, but significantly so. Bitcoin compensated investors twice as well for the risk they took than Facebook did, and 40% better than Netflix, its closest contender. Bitcoin and the FANG 4's Sharpe ratio comparison clearly illustrates the importance of combining solid returns and low volatility. While Facebook's annual returns were just shy of Amazon's and better than Google's, its volatility was significantly greater than both. Therefore, since its IPO, Facebook has compensated investors least well for the risk they've taken. Bitcoin's daily swings have dampened significantly over time, meaning its volatility is less. However, simultaneous with decreasing volatility, Bitcoin's annual appreciation has calmed as well. The year 2014 was the only time Bitcoin had a negative Sharpe ratio, when it lost 60% of its value from the start to the end of the year. Recall that 2014 was the year of Bitcoin's painful descent from its late 2013 high to its early 2015 low, with Chinese regulations, Mt. Gox implosions, and Silk Road associations plaguing the price of the asset. Meanwhile, 2016 was Bitcoin's best risk-adjusted return year since 2013. Digging into the comparison between 2013 and 2016, it's remarkable that 2013's Sharpe ratio was only double that of 2016, even though Bitcoin's returns in 2013 were so much greater. With capital appreciation in 2013 at 45 times greater than that of 2016, it would be reasonable to expect Bitcoin in 2013 to have had a Sharpe ratio many times greater than in 2016. However, this is where both daily volatility and the way the Sharpe ratio is calculated come into play. First, volatility in 2013 was triple that of 2016, which implies investors were taking three times as much risk in 2013 as in 2016. This allowed 2016 to have much lower returns, but still have a risk-reward ratio within the same ballpark as 2013. Second, the Sharpe ratio is calculated using average weekly returns, not total capital appreciation over the year. The Sharpe ratio is also revealing when comparing Bitcoin to the broader market indices of the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and the NASDAQ 100. We already know these indices had lower annual returns than Bitcoin and the FANG stocks, but they also had lower volatility given they were made up of diversified baskets of stocks, and diversification helps reduce volatility. Furthermore, these indices are made up of large market cap names, especially the Dow Jones Industrial Average. As we saw with AT&T, many of these large cap stocks have been around for a long time and are relatively steady when compared with fast-moving tech names. Absolute returns are tempered by volatility when calculating the Sharpe ratio. Although Bitcoin's Sharpe ratio is roughly 60% higher than the three broad market indices, this is a far cry from its absolute returns, which were roughly 20 times greater than the broad market indices on an annual basis during the same period. We compare Bitcoin's Sharpe ratio in 2016 to that of the broad market indices. Because 2016 was Bitcoin's lowest year of volatility in the range of a small to mid-cap stock, it is the most appropriate period to compare it to equities. What's most surprising is Bitcoin's Sharpe ratio in 2016 was almost as high as its overall Sharpe ratio since the launch of Mt. Gox, the first exchange that gave mainstream investors access to Bitcoin. 1.65 for 2016 versus 1.66 since Mt. Gox. Some people are apt to think that the best years to be a Bitcoin investor are past. However, looking at the Sharpe ratio, 2016 had risk-adjusted returns that were as good as those of an investor who bought Bitcoin when the mainstream first had the opportunity to do so. Correlation. Diversification is accomplished by selecting a variety of assets that have low to negative correlation with one another. A group of stocks is inherently more diversified than a single stock, and therefore the volatility should be lower. Crypto assets have near zero correlation to other capital market assets. The best explanation for this is that crypto assets are so new that many capital market investors don't play in the same asset pools. Therefore, crypto assets aren't dancing to the same rhythm of information as traditional capital market assets, at least not yet. If an asset is zero correlated to other assets in a portfolio, then considerable risk reduction is possible. In quantitative terms, reducing risk can be seen by a decrease in the volatility of the portfolio. If an asset merely reduces the risk of the overall portfolio by being lowly to negatively correlated with other assets, then it doesn't have to provide superior absolute returns to improve the risk-reward ratio of the overall portfolio. Since the Sharpe ratio is returns divided by risk, if the risk gets smaller, then the denominator gets smaller, making the Sharpe ratio bigger. The returns don't have to change at all. However, it is possible for an asset to be added to a portfolio that both decreases the risk of the portfolio and increases the returns. Finding assets that can do this is rare and almost feels like cheating the laws of risk-reward. After all, we've already learned that the more rewarding an asset is, the riskier it likely is. But with a portfolio, we are not talking about a single asset, but rather a group of them. It is the way in which a new asset behaves with the pre-existing group of assets in a portfolio that is the key to both reducing risk and increasing returns. Crypto assets as the silver bullet of diversification. Most people would reasonably expect that if they added Bitcoin to their portfolio, it would increase the absolute returns, but it would also make the portfolio significantly riskier, more volatile. However, it's important to remember that Bitcoin's propensity toward volatility proved true early in its life when volume was low, thin. In contrast, the past few years have been more nuanced. Bitcoin's volatility has calmed, yet it retains a low correlation with other assets. In some years, Bitcoin even provided the magical and elusive combination mentioned above of increasing the returns while also decreasing risk within a portfolio. The question is how Bitcoin's low to negative correlation with other capital market assets would have affected the volatility of a portfolio in which it was included. To perform our analysis, let's use the definition of a moderate investor laid forth by the American Association of Individual Investors, AAII. Per the AAII, a moderate investor allocates 70% to stocks and 30% to bonds, a common asset allocation model. The innovative investor can also be moderate and diversify beyond stocks and bonds into alternative assets, such as Bitcoin. Innovative yet moderate investors interested in Bitcoin could do so by taking a small piece of their equity portfolio, say 1%, and purchasing Bitcoin. In this way, they maintain their overall risk profile because equities are riskier than bonds, and so swapping one risky asset with another risky asset is a reasonable adjustment. We built a model to simulate how a 70% equities, 30% bonds portfolio would have behaved in comparison to a 1% Bitcoin, 69% equities, 30% bonds portfolio. For equities, we used the S&P 500 index, and for bonds, we used a broad-based U.S. bonds index known as the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. We calculated using quarterly rebalancing to maintain the original percentage target. As assets rise and fall, over time their percentages in a portfolio change. It's common practice to reassess each quarter and make small buy and sell transactions to reset the target percentages. For example, an investor that purchased a 1% position in Bitcoin 4 years ago would have had a whopping 32% allocation by the start of 2017. The difference between a 1% and 32% portfolio allocation creates a drastically different risk profile and would likely not be appropriate for all. Hence, the importance of rebalancing. What if the innovative investor had deployed 1% of his or her equity capital into Bitcoin at the start of 2013, peak of 2013, and start of 2015, done quarterly rebalancing, and held until our designated end date of January 3, 2017? Interestingly, while a 1% investment in any asset might seem insignificant, when done in Bitcoin, the results were definitive. At the start of 2013, Bitcoin was around $10 a coin and still had a tumultuous 2013 and 2014 in front of it. As a result, it's not surprising that there was an increase in both the absolute returns of the portfolio and the volatility. Compound annual returns proved superior with a 1% allocation to Bitcoin, and volatility was 4% higher. In this case, the volatility was worth it, because the Bitcoin portfolio had a 22% greater Sharpe ratio, offering more return for the risk taken. To underscore the significance of compound annual returns 3.2% greater over a 4-year period, we look at the end results. If both portfolios started at $100,000, the outperforming Bitcoin portfolio would have accumulated approximately $170,000. While the one without Bitcoin reached only about $150,000, a difference of $20,000 over 4 years. Now comes the true test of Bitcoin. If an investor had decided to deploy a 1% allocation into Bitcoin at its November 29, 2013 peak and held it until the start of 2017, what would have happened? It would be reasonable to expect that even a 1% allocation to Bitcoin would put a drag on the returns of the portfolio and also lower the Sharpe ratio. However, here is where the power of rebalancing and dollar cost averaging would have come into play. An investor would have endured 1 year of sliding prices, 2014, before then enjoying 2 years of rising prices, 2015 and 2016. By rebalancing quarterly, the investor would have been gradually adding to the Bitcoin portion of the portfolio to make up for the continually lower percentage due to its falling price. In effect, the investor would have been dollar cost averaging down. As a result, the compound annual returns of this period are about equal for the two portfolios. More surprisingly, the portfolio with Bitcoin would have had lower volatility. The power of diversification is becoming evident, and it leads to a marginally superior Sharpe ratio for the investor who held Bitcoin as a 1% position in his or her portfolio during this period. However, it is the two-year period between 2015 and 2017 that really shines. The portfolio with a 1% allocation of Bitcoin would have been less volatile. While improving compound annual returns by 0.6%, ultimately yielding a Sharpe ratio 14% better. Operating in the wild, innovative investors would have experienced the joy of a golden asset that both decreased volatility and increased returns when added to their portfolio, providing a double boost to the Sharpe ratio. In the previous chapter, we explored the necessary use of tools such as modern portfolio theory and asset allocation to build an effective investment portfolio, and to identify appropriate and compelling investment options for the innovative investor. In this chapter, we've looked through the lens of modern portfolio theory at Bitcoin as an investment over time. The next chapters will address the broad characteristics of Bitcoin and its digital siblings as an entirely new asset class with which the capital markets must reckon. Chapter 8. Defining crypto assets as a new asset class. Thus far, we've covered the birth of Bitcoin, the rise of blockchain as a general-purpose technology, a brief history of crypto assets at large, the keys to portfolio management, and how Bitcoin would have performed in the context of modern portfolio theory over its first 8 years of life. What the innovative investor now needs is a framework to understand the general patterns to be expected of all crypto assets going forward. To set the foundation for that framework, we need to first define what type of asset a crypto asset is. Are Bitcoin and its digital siblings to be defined as commodities, as the Commodities Futures Trading Commission seems to believe? Or are they better thought of as property, as the Internal Revenue Service has set forth? The Securities and Exchange Commission has thus far steered clear of applying a specific label to all crypto assets, though in late July 2017, it did release a report detailing how some crypto assets can be classified as securities, with the most notable example being the Dow. While it's a great validation of crypto assets that regulators are working to provide clarity on how to classify at least some of them, most of the existing laws set forth suffer from the same flaw. Agencies are interpreting crypto assets through the lens of the past. What further complicates the situation is that not all crypto assets are made equal. Just as there is diversity in equities, with analysts segmenting companies depending on their market capitalization, sector, or geography, so too is there diversity in crypto assets. Bitcoin, Litecoin, Monero, Dash, and Zcash fulfill three definitions of a currency, serving as a means of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. However, as we've seen, many other crypto assets function as digital commodities or crypto commodities. These crypto commodities include Ether, Storge, Sia, and Gollum. Meanwhile, there are myriad crypto tokens for end-user-specific applications, such as Augur, Steam, Singular DTV, or game credits. Moreover, all crypto assets are alive with code that morphs based on the evolution of use cases and the value add that the core open source developers feel their crypto asset can best fulfill. How can a regulator possibly hope to put a crypto asset in a category that is centuries old, when these assets are redefining themselves and breaking their own boundaries every couple of years, if not every couple of months? They can't. The point is not to bash regulators, but to show how hard it is to classify a brand new asset class, especially when it is the first digital native asset class the world has seen. What is an asset class, anyway? While people accept that equities and bonds are the two major investment asset classes, and others will accept that money market funds, real estate, precious metals and currencies are other commonly used asset classes, few bother to understand what is meant by an asset class in the first place. Robert Greer, vice president of Daiwa Securities, wrote, "What is an asset class anyway?" A seminal paper on the definition of an asset class in a 1997 issue of the Journal of Portfolio Management. According to Greer, an asset class is a set of assets that bear some fundamental economic similarities to each other, and that have characteristics that make them distinct from other assets that are not part of that class. Still fuzzy. Greer then goes on to define three superclasses of assets. Capital assets, consumable transformable assets, store of value assets. Greer has the following to say about how to identify each superclass from the others. Capital assets. One thing all these capital assets have in common. A capital asset might reasonably be valued on the basis of the net present value of its expected returns. Therefore, everything else being equal, which it never really is, a financial capital asset, such as a stock or a bond, will decline in value as the investor's discount rate increases, or rise as that rate decreases. This economic characteristic unifies the superclass of capital assets. Consumable, transformable, CT assets. You can consume it. You can transform it into another asset. It has economic value. But it does not yield an ongoing stream of value. The profound implication of this distinction is that CT assets, not being capital in nature, cannot be valued using net present value analysis. This makes them truly economically distinct from the superclass of capital assets. CT assets must be valued more often on the basis of the particular supply and demand characteristics of their specific market. Store of value assets. The third superclass of asset cannot be consumed, nor can it generate income. Nevertheless, it has value. It is a store of value asset. One example is fine art. A broader and more relevant example is the category of currency, either foreign or domestic. Store of value assets can serve as a refuge during uncertainty, U.S. cash, or offer currency diversification to the portfolio. Author note, he does not define how to price it. Greer's superclasses are not clear-cut, as some assets can fall into two camps. For example, precious metals are both CT assets and store of value assets. They are used in the circuitry of electronics, or transformed into ornate forms of decoration, CT asset. And they are also held solely as bars of value, not meant for consumption or transformation of any kind, store of value asset. Crypto assets most obviously fall into the CT realm because they have utility and are consumed digitally. For example, developers use Ether to gain access to Ethereum's world computer, which then can perform operations on smart contracts stored in Ethereum's blockchain. Hence, Ether is consumed in the operation of a world computer. Then there is attention, the fuel of advertising, which is leading to the creation of blockchain-based attention markets. Steemit is a social media platform with a native crypto asset Steem that rewards content creators and curators. Steem creates an economic system that rewards creators for new quality content because that content enhances the platform, thereby increasing the value of Steem. While many crypto assets are priced by the dynamics of supply and demand in markets, similar to more traditional CT assets, for some holders of Bitcoin, like holders of gold bars, it is solely a store of value. Other investors use crypto assets beyond Bitcoin in a similar way, holding the asset in the hope that it appreciates over time. Therefore, one could make the case that crypto assets are like precious metals in that they belong to two superclasses of assets. According to Greer, beneath these superclasses, there are classes, and within the classes, there are subclasses. These classifications can help innovative investors understand the different ways in which their investments relate to one another and enable them to best diversify their portfolios. For example, within the superclass of capital assets, there is the class of equities. And within the class of equities, there are subclasses, like large cap value or small cap growth. Crypto assets are a class that falls between the CT and store of value superclasses. Within the crypto assets class, there are the subclasses of cryptocurrencies, crypto commodities, and crypto tokens. ETFs and mutual funds are wrappers, not asset classes. It should be noted that when we talk about asset classes, we are not doing so in the context of the investment vehicle that may house the underlying asset, whether that vehicle is a mutual fund, ETF, or separately managed account. With the growth of financial engineering and securitization of nearly every asset, and especially with the growing popularity of ETFs, one may find every type of asset at some point housed within an ETF. For example, ETFs for Bitcoin and Ether are already in the filing process with the SEC. For the purpose of our definition of asset classes, we are distinguishing the asset class from the form within which they are traded. Delineating the separation between asset classes is no easy task. Greer gives us one solid point to distinguish assets, the economic similarities, but then leaves the rest to characteristics that make them distinct. We've reviewed the academic literature further in order to crystallize the difference between asset classes. Much of the thinking in this chapter grew out of a collaboration between ARK Invest and Coinbase through late 2015 and into 2016, when the two firms first made the claim that Bitcoin was ringing the bell for a new asset class. Key differentiators between asset classes. In our investigation of economic characteristics, we find the main differences come down to governance, supply schedule, use cases, and basis of value. Beyond economic similarities, asset classes also tend to have similar liquidity and trading volume profiles. Remember that a liquidity profile refers to how deep the order book of the markets is, while trading volume refers to how much is traded daily. Lastly, asset classes differ in their marketplace behavior, the most important of which include risk, reward, and correlation with other assets. A general pattern exists of assets belonging in the same class behaving in a similar fashion. While each unique asset in a class will behave slightly differently from others, they resemble one another more closely than they resemble assets from other classes. Brand new assets within a class will differ in their behavior from more mature assets in the same class. Differences in maturity are particularly relevant for crypto assets, with its oldest asset being only 8 years old and newborns arriving on a weekly cadence. At the moment, crypto assets are best described as an emerging class. Their economic characteristics of governance, supply schedule, use cases, and basis of value are relatively fixed from the genesis of any particular crypto asset. What will change more over time are the liquidity profile and marketplace characteristics as these assets mature. The remainder of this chapter will focus on the economic characteristics of crypto assets, while the next chapter will dive into the progression of liquidity profiles and marketplace characteristics of different crypto assets over time, and how those trends compare with other assets. Economic characteristics of an asset class. For the innovative investor, evaluating crypto assets requires similar analysis as other assets. The starting point is to recognize and identify those economic characteristics that qualify them as their own asset class. We believe that this can be done by evaluating them on the basis of four criteria. How are they governed? Just as countries are governed, so too are assets. Typically, there are three layers of governance for assets of all kinds: the procurers of the asset, the people holding the asset, and a regulatory body or multiple regulatory bodies to oversee the behavior of the procurers and the holders. For example, a typical equity has the management of the underlying company, the shareholders of the company, and the SEC as a regulatory overseer. Energy commodities and their associated derivatives, such as oil and natural gas, are arguably more complex. The governance of the procurers is often much more dispersed and global in nature, as are the holders of the physical commodities. For the financial derivatives of these commodities, in the U.S., the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, provides a layer of regulatory cohesiveness, while the SEC plays the same role for ETFs, mutual funds, and other fund structures that are composed of these assets. Currency, a somewhat more controversial asset class, also has a unique governance profile. First, a central bank controls its distribution, while the people of the country, global businesses, and international creditors often dictate the exchange rate and use of the currency, though a controlling nation can manipulate these arenas. Regulatory bodies vary by nation, and there are international regulatory bodies like the International Monetary Fund if the currency of a nation hits choppy water. Crypto assets adhere to a 21st century model of governance unique from all other asset classes, and largely inspired by the open source software movement. The procurers of the asset and associated use cases are three-pronged. First, a group of talented software developers decide to create the blockchain protocol or distributed application that utilizes a native asset. These developers adhere to an open contributor model, which means that over time, any new developer can earn his or her way onto the development team through merit. However, the developers are not the only ones in charge of procuring a crypto asset. They only provide the code. The people who own and maintain the computers that run the code, the miners, also have a say in the development of the code, because they have to download new software updates. The developers can't force miners to update software. Instead, they must convince them that it makes sense for the health of the overall blockchain and the economic health of the miner to do so. In addition to the developers and miners, there is a third level of governance among the procurers, the companies that offer services that interface between the crypto asset and the broader public. These companies often employ some of the core developers, but even if they don't, they can assert significant influence over the system if they are a large force behind user adoption. After the three groups of procurers, there are the holders or the end users who buy the crypto asset for investment purposes or to gain access to the utility of the underlying blockchain architecture. These users are constantly providing feedback to the developers, miners, and companies in whose interest it is to listen. Because if users stop using the crypto asset, then demand will go down, and so too will the price. Therefore, the procurers are constantly held accountable by the users. Last, there is an emerging regulatory landscape for crypto assets. However, regulators are still considering exactly how they want to handle this emerging asset class. What is the supply schedule? The supply schedule of an asset can be influenced by its three layers of governance, but the procurers typically have the strongest hand. For example, with equities, there is an initial share issuance via an initial public offering, IPO. The IPO helps the management of the underlying company raise cash from the capital markets and get broader exposure for their company's brand. The company can continue to issue shares via stock-based compensation or secondary offerings, but if they do so at too high a quantity, their investors may rebel because their ownership of the company is becoming diluted. Bonds, on the other hand, are markedly different from equities. Once a company, government, or other entity issues a bond, that is a claim upon a fixed amount of debt. There is no negotiating on that debt except in the case of default. That same entity may issue more bonds going forward, but unless that issuance is an indicator of economic distress, typically a follow-on issuance of bonds will have little effect on a prior set of issued bonds. Depending on the energy commodity, there can be varied supply schedules, though nearly all of them are calibrated to balance market supply and demand, and to avoid supply gluts that hurt all procurers. For example, with oil, there's the famous Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, which has had considerable control over the supply levels of oil. The central banks that control currency supply have even more control than OPEC. As the world has witnessed since the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, a central bank can choose to issue as much currency in the form of quantitative easing as it wants. It does this most often through open market operations, such as buying back government-issued bonds and other assets to inject cash into the economy. Central bank activity can lead to drastic increases in the supply of a fiat currency, as we have seen in the U.S. dollar. Precious metals have long been valued for their scarcity and aesthetic appeal, even though as metals, most are largely inferior to other more common metals. Their malleability makes them impossible to use for structural support, as they can easily be deformed. However, due to their scarcity and now near universal acceptance as a form of beauty, they have come to be considered a relatively safe store of value. Gold supply is on an inflationary schedule. In other words, each year more gold is pulled out of the ground than the year before, much to the surprise of many gold bugs. Crypto assets like gold are often constructed to be scarce in their supply. Many will be even more scarce than gold and other precious metals. The supply schedule of crypto assets typically is metered mathematically and set in code at the genesis of the underlying protocol or distributed application. Bitcoin provides for a maximum of 21 million units by 2140, and it gets there by cutting the rate of supply inflation every 4 years. Currently, the supply schedule is at 4% annually. In 2020, that will be cut to 2% annually. And in 2024, it will drop to 1% annually. As discussed earlier, Satoshi crafted the system this way because he needed initially to bootstrap support for Bitcoin, which he did by issuing large amounts of the coin for the earliest contributors. As Bitcoin matured, the value of its native asset appreciated, which means less Bitcoin had to be issued to continue to motivate people to contribute. Now that Bitcoin is over 8 years old, it provides strong utility to the world beyond as an investment, which drives demand. Over time, next to zero Bitcoin will be issued, but the aim is for the network to be so big by then that all contributors get paid a sufficient amount via transaction fees, just like Visa or MasterCard. Many other crypto assets follow a similar model of mathematical issuance, though they differ widely in the exact rates. For example, Ethereum initially planned to issue 18 million Ether each year in perpetuity. The thinking was that as the underlying base of Ether grew, these 18 million units would become an increasingly small percentage of the monetary base. As a result, the rate of supply inflation would ultimately converge on 0%. The Ethereum team is currently rethinking that issuance strategy due to an intended change in its consensus mechanism. Choosing to change the issuance schedule of a crypto asset from the plan at time of launch is more the exception than the norm, though since the asset class is still young, we are not surprised by such experimentation. Steemit's team pursued a far more complicated monetary policy with its platform, composed of Steem, Steem Power, and Steem Dollars. The founding team initially chose Steem to increase in supply by 100% per year. While they incorporated a wrinkle that would decrease the total units outstanding by periodically dividing it to combat outrageously large numbers, they quickly discovered that even this modification would not be enough to avoid an unsustainably high rate of inflation and devaluation of the platform. They have also chosen to modify their monetary policy post-inception. Steemit is an example of why innovative investors should investigate the monetary policy of a platform to make sure it makes economic sense and avoid being caught in a situation similar to the Steem bubble that we will detail in Chapter 10. As each individual crypto asset matures, we expect the monetary policy to ossify into its mathematically metered intent. How are they used? Governance and supply schedules play an important role in the use cases of an asset. For equities and bonds, the use cases are straightforward. Equities allow a company to raise capital from the capital markets via issuance of shares, while bonds allow a company to raise capital via the issuance of debt. Currencies are clear-cut in their use cases as well, serving as a means of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. Commodities are where use cases can become more diverse. The use cases for metals or semiconducting agents changes as technology progresses. For example, silicon was once a forgotten element, but with the age of semiconductors, it has become vital, causing arguably the most innovative valley in the world to be named after it, though there is no physical silicon to be taken from the ground there. Crypto assets can be likened to silicon. They have come upon the scene due to the rise of technology, and their use cases will grow and change as technology evolves. Currently, Bitcoin is the most straightforward, with its use case being that of a decentralized global currency. Ether is more flexible, as developers use it for computational gas within a decentralized world computer. Augur facilitates prediction markets on a decentralized system, economically compensating or punishing individuals for telling the truth or lies. Then there are the trading markets, which trade 24/7, 365 days a year. These global and eternally open markets also differentiate crypto assets from the other assets discussed herein. In short, the use cases for crypto assets are more dynamic than any pre-existing asset class. Furthermore, since they're brought into the world and then controlled by open-source software, the ability for crypto assets to evolve is unbounded. What is the basis of value? As Greer mentioned in his definition of superclasses, capital assets like equities and bonds are value based on the net present value, NPV, of all future cash flows. With net present value, Greer refers to the idea that a dollar tomorrow is worth less than a dollar today. For example, if an investor puts $100 in a savings account and earns a 5% annual return, in the good old days, then 1 year from now, that $100 will be worth $105. Therefore, investors either want the $100 today or the $105 a year from now. But they don't want the $100 a year from now, or they've effectively lost money. CT assets are priced by market dynamics of supply and demand, as are the more liquid store of value assets like currencies. However, it should be noted with currencies that the governance of the issuing nation can meddle with the exchange rate and therefore basis of value of the currency. Value assets like fine art are the hardest and most subjective to value, as often beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Crypto assets have two drivers of their basis of value, utility and speculative. Digital units of Bitcoin don't exist beyond unspent transaction outputs, or credits, in Bitcoin's blockchain. Therefore, a significant portion of the basis of value is what the underlying blockchain enables the users of the assets to do. In other words, Bitcoin's utility value. Utility value refers to what the underlying blockchain is used for, and therefore what the demand is for its asset. For example, Bitcoin's blockchain is used to transact Bitcoin, and therefore much of the value is driven by demand to use Bitcoin as a means of exchange. Similarly, Bitcoin can be used as a store of value, so a percentage of the Bitcoin outstanding is demanded for that use case. All these use cases temporarily bind Bitcoin, drawing it out of the supply of Bitcoin outstanding. The more that people want to use Bitcoin, the more they'll have to pay to get access to it. On top of utility value, there's a speculative value to a crypto asset. Since crypto assets are all under a decade old, much is still left to be seen regarding how each will develop, which is where speculative value comes into play. Speculative value is driven by people trying to predict how widely used a particular crypto asset will be in the future. It's similar to new publicly traded companies, where much of the market capitalization of the company is based on what investors expect from it in the future. As a result, the multiple of sales at which the company is valued is much greater than the multiple of sales that a more mature company will trade at. For example, a young fast-growing company with $100 million in revenue may be worth $1 billion, whereas a much older company that is hardly growing may have $500 million in sales and also be worth $1 billion. With these two companies, the younger one has greater investor speculation about the future cash flow of the company baked into what it's worth. While with the older company, investors are valuing it much more closely to its current revenue situation because they know more or less what they'll be getting going forward. With crypto assets, much of the speculative value can be derived from the development team. People will have more faith that a crypto asset will be widely adopted if it is crafted by a talented and focused development team. Furthermore, if the development team has a grand vision for the widespread use of the crypto asset, then that can increase the speculative value of the asset. As each crypto asset matures, it will converge on its utility value. Right now, Bitcoin is the furthest along the transition from speculative price support to utility price support because it has been around the longest and people are using it regularly for its intended utility use cases. For example, in 2016, $100,000 of Bitcoin was transacted every minute, which creates real demand for the utility of the asset beyond its trading demand. A great illustration of Bitcoin's price support increasingly being tied to utility came from Pantera Capital, a well-respected investment firm solely focused on crypto assets and technology. In November 2013, Bitcoin's speculative value skyrocketed beyond its utility value. Speculative value diminishes as a crypto asset matures because there is less speculation regarding the future markets the crypto asset will penetrate. This means people will understand more clearly what demand for the asset will look like going forward. The younger the crypto asset is, the more its value will be driven by speculative value. While we expect crypto assets to ossify into their primary use cases over time, especially as they become large systems that support significant amounts of value, their open-source nature leaves open the possibility that they will be tweaked to pursue new tangential use cases, which could once again add speculative value to the asset. Speculative value in young markets is hard to estimate and can be dangerous to play with, as often only a few investors have a good basis for the future value of the asset, while the rest follow the movement of the market. Benjamin Graham uses a famous example in his classic investing book, The Intelligent Investor, where he personifies the market as Mr. Market, who is prone to oscillation between dark and ebullient moods. When Mr. Market is dark, he'll throw assets around, damaging their value to beneath their utility value. When Mr. Market is ebullient, he'll pay most any price for assets, driving them far above their utility value with hefty speculative premiums. Mr. Market is a fictional representation of the movement of crowds, and Graham suggests that investors do their fundamental work on the asset, and from there, ignore the moods of Mr. Market. Speaking of Mr. Market, let's discuss how crypto asset marketplace behavior evolves over time. Chapter 9. The Evolution of Crypto Asset Market Behavior. In the previous chapter, we discussed what differentiated asset classes from one another. We identified economic characteristics, liquidity and trading volume profiles, and marketplace behavior as key differentiators. The economic characteristics covered in Chapter 8 are largely well-defined at the launch of an asset, though any given crypto asset's economic characteristics may evolve more than a stock, and certainly more than a bond, given the nature of its open-source software. Inarguably, the liquidity and trading volume profiles, along with the marketplace behavior of an asset class, and individual examples within an asset class, mature considerably over time. For example, in 1602, when the United Dutch Chartered East India Company, Dutch East India Company for short, became the first company to issue stock, the shares were extremely illiquid. When first issued, no stock market even existed, and purchasers were expected to hold on to the shares for 21 years, the length of time granted to the company by the Netherlands Charter over trade in Asia. However, some investors wanted to sell their shares, perhaps to pay down debts, and so an informal market for the stock, the very first stock market, developed in the Amsterdam East India House. As more joint stock equity companies were founded, this informal location grew and was later formalized as the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, the oldest modern securities exchange in the world. Despite the structure of the shares of the Dutch East India Company not changing much, their market liquidity and trading volumes changed considerably. Similarly, when Bitcoin, the first crypto asset and therefore the crypto analog to the Dutch East India Company, was issued through the mining process, there was no market to transact or trade Bitcoin. For much of 2009, there were hardly any Bitcoin transactions, even though a new batch of 50 Bitcoin was minted every 10 minutes. It wasn't until October 2009 that the first recorded transaction of Bitcoin for the U.S. dollar took place. 5,050 Bitcoin for $5.02, paid via PayPal. This transaction was sent from one of Bitcoin's earliest proselytizers, Marty Malmy, to an individual using the name New Liberty Standard, who was trying to set up the world's first consistent place of exchange between Bitcoin and the U.S. dollar. To say it was an exchange in the sense of the word that we think of today would be an overstatement. New Liberty Standard's attempt to create a trading location for Bitcoin was sparsely populated and illiquid. Yet the idea was there. It wouldn't be until the summer of 2010 that a formidable place of exchange would come into existence. In short, the Bitcoin markets took time to develop, just as those for stocks or any other asset class. The asset can stay the same, but the functioning markets around it and the way the asset changes hands can morph considerably. For example, currently, the bond markets are undergoing significant changes as a surprising amount of bond trading is still a voice and paper market, where trades are made by institutions calling one another and tangible paper is processed. This makes the bond market much more illiquid and opaque than the stock market, where most transactions are done almost entirely electronically. With the growing wave of digitalization, the bond markets are becoming increasingly liquid and transparent. The same can be said of markets for commodities, art, fine wine, and so on. Crypto assets have an inherent advantage in their liquidity and trading volume profile because they are digital natives. As digital natives, crypto assets have no physical form and can be moved as quickly as the internet can move the ones and zeros that convey ownership. The rapidity with which crypto assets can be moved sets them apart from other asset classes, especially alternative assets like art, real estate, and fine wines, and should enable more liquid markets much earlier in their developmental history. Correlations between assets are also relevant in the evolution of an asset class. Recall from Chapter 6 that correlation refers to the prices of assets moving together. With the globalization of markets, correlations have largely increased as national economies are attached at the hip. Many still turn to gold in risk-off periods when they want something safe from the groupthink trading in the bond and equity markets. As of April 2017, the aggregate network value for crypto assets was so small on a relative basis, storing less than $30 billion in value, that they had yet to penetrate most traditional investor capital pools. Even though they are growing at an incredible clip, separation between crypto asset markets and traditional investor capital pools still largely remains the case. As a result, crypto assets currently have little correlation with traditional assets. However, we increasingly see signs of correlation between Bitcoin and the broader capital markets, either negative or positive correlation, which makes sense as Bitcoin is the most well-established crypto asset and will likely be the first for traditional investors to venture into. Over time, we expect increasing correlations, once again either negative or positive, between crypto assets and other asset classes as overlap between the entities using these investments increases. The transition from an emerging asset class to a mature asset class involves being accepted by the broader capital markets. It's critical for the innovative investor to understand the liquidity and trading volume profiles of crypto assets and how they change as they mature. Given Bitcoin's status and tenure, we'll begin there. Then, for comparison, we'll pull in relevant examples from other top crypto assets by market cap, such as Ether, Dash, Ripple, Monero, and Litecoin. Bitcoin's liquidity and trading volume profile. Bitcoin's liquidity has improved dramatically over time, and exchanges have grown from just Mt. Gox in July 2010 to over 40 as of the start of 2017. Equally, the order books of individual exchanges have matured. For example, consider that on the first day Mt. Gox traded Bitcoin, only 20 were traded, totaling 99 cents of value. On opening day, Mt. Gox had an extremely thin order book. Now, sites such as Bitcoinity.org provide metrics like spread 100 BTC percent, showing how much the price of Bitcoin would move on different exchanges if 100 Bitcoin were bought. Greater liquidity is created from more trading activity as there are more people buying and selling Bitcoin. Global trading volume since the opening of Mt. Gox have increased exponentially. On January 5, 2017, Bitcoin trading activity clocked in at over $11 billion, and Bitcoin broke through $1,000 a coin for the second time in its history. Just as trading equities evolved from an informal venue in Amsterdam to trading hundreds of billions of dollars daily in exchanges all over the world, so too has Bitcoin evolved. We now have tens of exchanges globally trading hundreds of millions to billions of dollars daily. This increase in trading volume is a function of increased interest, which has driven maturation in Bitcoin markets. The evolution of crypto asset trading volumes. Other crypto assets show similar trends as they mature, but because they're younger than Bitcoin, their variability in volume and liquidity is greater. For example, in 2016, Monero experienced a sizable increase in notoriety, largely because its privacy features began to be utilized by a well-known dark market, which sent its average trading volume skyrocketing. In December 2015, daily volume for the asset was $27,300. But by December 2016, it was $3.25 million, well over a hundredfold increase. The price of the asset had appreciated more than 20-fold in the same period, so some of the increase in trading volume was due to price appreciation. But clearly, a large amount was due to increased interest and trading activity in the asset. To varying degrees, Ether, Dash, Litecoin, Ripple, and other crypto assets have shown similar increases in trading volume as they have matured. Many crypto assets will enjoy significant boosts in trading volumes upon sizable price appreciation because a rising asset catches the attention of more investors and traders. However, once the crypto asset settles down into a price range, its trading volume will often settle into a new range as well. Some crypto asset traders will then look for increases in volume as an early indicator that interest is picking up, and that a move in the asset's price could be on the horizon. Regardless of whether or not traders are right, burgeoning interest, trading volumes, and market liquidity all point to a maturing crypto asset. If sustained, all of these are good indicators of health for the innovative investor to be aware of. If, however, the rise in trading volumes looks too steep and there is little news as to why, then that is reason to be wary. As we will cover in the next two chapters on speculation, sometimes volumes that rise too far and too fast can be a sign of manipulation or overheating markets. Regulatory impact on market liquidity. While the innovative investor can generally expect assets with real value to mature and increase in liquidity and trading over time, External factors that impact markets can significantly dampen trading volume. Investors become skittish, and at times regulation can forcibly clamp down on overenthusiasm. What helps an asset through these difficult periods is the diversity and depth of the exchanges and trading pairs offered globally. On January 6, 2017, the day after Bitcoin hit an all-time high trading volume of $11 billion in one day,